Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 19 of the Overthrows podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at DefMango on Twitter. And with me, back from vacation, is Jared Kimber, who you can find literally anywhere. And just before we get into the cricket, Jared, how was your vacation? Was Blenheim Palace Blenheiming?
You know what? I played an awful lot of cricket with my son. We were there, and he spent a lot of time whacking balls into people's cars and other holiday houses. So my bowling certainly didn't handle the holiday.
All right, then. I mean, it does sound like a fun vacation if cricket was involved. We've got Dr. Daywalker, Arco, and Soham Chatterjee in the comment section already. And sorry to be late again, guys, and keep you waiting. We know that that's a bit of a trend. And we're going to start off the show with the T20 World Cup roundup. And let's start with the most recent game. Cloudy with a chance of dot balls in New York, Jared. What were those playing conditions? Uneven bounce, a horrendous outfield. Then there was this massive boundary square of the wicket. And South Africa's, you know, tall, fast bowlers were just pitching in short to get the Sri Lankan batters to pull. And I think there were at least three dismissals like that. So, you know, atrocious decision-making as well on Sri Lanka's batter's part. And the running was also quite terrible. What do you make of all of that?
I wonder if the wicket wasn't worse in the second innings than it was in the first. I mean, I think it was actually actively getting worse. You look at Tikshana's ball. I think it was Tikshana, not Hasaranga. The ball one that rolled along the ground. Like, it was bad. And if you go back to the 92 World Cup when they were playing games in regional Australia, I don't think the wickets in regional New Zealand were quite as bad, but certainly some of the wickets in regional Australia were terrible. We got essentially, you know, a test nation out of it. Like Zimbabwe beating England was on one of the worst wickets of all time, where it probably specifically helped medium fast skiddy bowlers, and Edo Brandes obviously took the top off that chase. So look, it's remarkable. That's where they wanted to play the tournament. Everyone made that decision. The pitch in Dallas looked fine to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Morrisville.
It was an absolute belter.
Morrisville, I've seen a lot of cricket. Is it Morrisville? I think it's called Morrisville. The one where they play a lot of the minor league cricket and played there before. Again, decent wicket. Some of the other surfaces in major league cricket were a bit up and down. Minor league cricket, some of the other surfaces, which is why they've restricted to a couple of grounds. Florida can be a bit up and down. That wicket today was not of international quality. I'm not having anything at all. with the fact that Sri Lanka made some bad decisions. Of course, they made bad decisions. It did four different things, that pitch, right? It had pace and carry, right? So if you got a bowler at 90 miles an hour, the ball was zinging through and Quinton de Kock was taking it up here. Then the very next ball of the very same length would go up like a tennis ball and come down. Then you had balls keeping low, and then you had massive, inconsistent seam movement as well.
Yep.
I mean, you can't say that the Sri Lankans batted badly if Dasan Shanakar, what were his figures in the end? Like 1 for 3?
I don't know, but he was bowling like peak Glenn McGrath, right?
If he's bowling like that, it can't be the decision-making of the batters. I think early on, you know, there were probably some times when, and this includes the South African batters as well, the pitch probably melted some minds, right? Like there's a couple of wickets that probably did melt the minds. But have a look at the two wickets later on for Hasaranga. I think both of his wickets. The ball just stopped on the wicket, right? Yep. Like you can't just push your bat through. It was absolutely in no way an international quality wicket. And it's, you know, it's a bit of a problem, because don't they have 7 more games lined up at that ground, if I'm not mistaken? Plus, I could be wrong, but if one that a few people might watch. There weren't that many people watching today, right? If we have a wicket like that, and also look at the South African bowlers. I mean, I don't know what's worse, when you have 90 mile an hour bowlers that are just pinging the ball into the pitch and it could do anything, or if you turn Dasan Shanakar into the world's best bowler. Like, there's no good side of this. I certainly wouldn't want to face Bumrah on this wicket, or Shaheen Afridi or Nazim Shah or I wouldn't want to face a bowler on this wicket, if we're being honest. And we haven't talked about the outfield, which was literally like the ball was hit. If you hit the ball on the ground, it just stopped.
My backyard has a better outfield. Oh. I'm not even joking.
I didn't see the warm-up game. Was it Bangladesh India played a warm-up game there? Did you see any of that?
Yes. I did not see it, but I know that it wasn't played on this particular surface. Well, it was the one right beside it. And India did get around to score 180 odd, right? I don't know how different those two surfaces are, but it was like partly the pitch and the ball was like stopping in the pitch. Even Maharaj got it to stop, right? But the outfield just made it all the more worse. Like you have to go aerial and clear the rope because even if you hit like, you know, those fours, which are always one bounce, not on this surface. It's going to stop there.
Yeah, it was ridiculous, wasn't it? Some of the shots said the amount of twos that were scored. The amount of, I don't think I've ever seen a T20 game with so many twos and dot balls. That's literally all we saw was twos and dot balls. And then very occasionally, like once every eight overs, there was a six hit. And it was one. We can make fun of it all we want, but if it's this bad again in this tournament and it's another major game, this is a major game. These are two teams, you know, who had a chance. And if South Africa had lost that game, it would have been completely the pitch, right? Like if they'd lost that game, it's a bit different for Sri Lanka because, you know, they were batting first and I do think the wicket was slightly better. It's still mostly the pitch, but if South Africa had lost that game, who do they turn to? Are the ICC going to find themselves? I want Rambo to come out, Ramiz Raja to come out and start talking about this pitch because it's about as bad as I've seen at international level for a very, very long time. And we've already had like the Guyana pitch and even the Bridgetown pitch was, you know, a bit of a weird one, right? It's not like the other pitches have been great. The best pitch was probably the first game at Dallas.
I mean, Dallas is an absolute belter, that much we know. But with respect to this one, I agree it wasn't of international quality. It was almost the antithesis of the Ramiz Raja pitches in Rawalpindi, right? And I am all for bowling-friendly conditions. A lot of people were tweeting that this is refreshing, that the bowlers have to get a go. Look, bowler-friendly pitches are one thing, and then this atrocity, whatever that it was that we saw today, is a completely different thing.
If you bowled out for 77, it's not bowler-friendly, is it? It's not up to scratch, right? And the fact that, and if South Africa had gone out and blitzed, we could at least go back to your point and go, maybe we're thinking back the two wickets in a row when Hasaranga and, was it Sidira, went out back to back. Maybe we'd say to ourselves, do you know what? They played a small part in it. You know, some of the running between wickets was a bit weird, all that sort of thing. I think that's very, very fair, right? But that's not what happened. In fact, it looked worse to bat on when South Africa were out there. And part of that is because different kinds of bowlers. That was the other thing. It'd be really interesting to look at the Hawkeye data because you had like four guys bowling at 90 miles an hour from high heights in one innings. Then you had two slingers, two spinners, and two of the most gentle medium paces of all time. But when Angelo Matthews is almost gelding a batter, I think we know that there is something really wrong with that surface. Like this is just not a normal wicket at all. And it's the worst thing that's happened in this World Cup. I get the people who are like, oh, it's bowler friendly and everything else. I'm on board with that, right?
Yeah,
that wasn't bowler friendly. That was not friendly to cricket, right? That's that level above. And we have, you know, I can't remember what the ICC ratings are for pitches, but there's one that says unsafe. I had friends messaging me, people in cricket, messaging me going, if this was a franchise game, would they have called this off? Right?
True.
And I think in some leagues, they would have. My friend Jake sent me a message going, if this was a Big Bash game, they probably would have just stopped playing on it, right? Some of those balls, there was a collage they showed of the short balls to the Sri Lankans with the Hawkeye. And it was like the two balls bounced on exactly the same spot. And one skidded through really low and dangerous. And the other one bounced up like it was a rubber ball. Like, how are you supposed to bat against that?
No way. I mean, I completely agree. I don't think that this sort of surface is international cricket friendly. And also, like, I would love some games where, you know, 160 is a great target. But 77 all out is not a bowler friendly pitch. It is not a surface on which you should be playing.
And I'll ask you this. Do you think if they'd made 95, they would have been able to defend it?
I think 110 was defendable. And plus, even if like Kusal Mendes had not dropped stubs and at that point two more wickets fell, who knows? Maybe 77 would have been defended, right?
I honestly think 95 would have been a really, really interesting game, right? And you know, 105, 110, 115, 120, fine. If 95 is in the game, there's probably something wrong there.
Absolutely. And that's not how you want to sell cricket to America, right? There's something large at stake over here. But anyway, some of the performances, of course, Anrik Nokia, after a dreadful IPL, was player of the match in this game. His most economical spell ever, took 4 for 7. And basically, that's lesser runs than he would concede in half an over in the IPL, right? That's pretty much it.
Pretty sure he went for more than 7 runs a ball in the IPL. you know, he had a horror run. If you're on the preview show, you would have heard me say that his coach was talking him up, and coaches don't generally do that unless they've seen something. Fast bowlers, and we've seen this with Lockie Ferguson before, and even Pat Cummins, although you know, less so with Pat Cummins at times. But if you do lose a fraction of pace, you can sometimes just become, especially in limited overs cricket, you get smashed around. He looks very fast today, but I have no idea if he's back in form or not, or he was just bowling on that wicket. Bartman, whom I'm a big fan of, I didn't think he bowled particularly well today. No one was hitting him. And, you know, I reckon I would back myself to get through half an over of Dustin Charnica normally. I'm not sure he would have got me out of every ball today.
Yeah. Bartman was actually quite good in that one game he played versus the West Indies as well when you were off on vacation today. 1 for 9 in 4 overs. When I saw his bowling, I was like, test match bowler, nagging lengths, right? Not quite sure how he'll fare in this T20 World Cup. Again, we can praise those guys, but we don't really know because the surface was such. One last thing on this game, Jared. What was up with Mahesh Teekshana bowling his first over in like the 15th or 16th over, whatever it was? I did not understand.
It probably wasn't that late, but it probably felt like that late. Maybe it was. Yeah. I can't even remember.
Maybe it was the 14th over.
Yeah, it was.
It might have been.
It wasn't early, was it? It certainly wasn't at the start. I think that, to be fair to them, they got some things right. I wouldn't have brought Charnica on when they brought Charnica on, even though I thought he would have been handy on this wicket, because I would have been like, well, Charnica can nibble out a couple of wickets, but Partharana, if this wicket helps him, how the hell are you going to play him on this wicket, right? And some of the balls that he got to bounce from ridiculous angles, we kind of saw that, but he didn't bowl as well as the slow medium pace, so they probably got that right. But they brought Hasaranga on before Teekshana, and it's like, Teekshana is more like a medium pacer. This should be his ideal surface. And then we saw him almost straight away run one along the ground. So yeah, they made a couple of errors there. But you know, look, in truth, I still think that, like, if I was South Africa, I don't think I would have brought Maharaja on for the seventh over either, right? Like, sometimes when a wicket is that weird, you don't really know what you're supposed to be doing. And I do think there was an element of that being played out there. I think Estelle might have sent this in on a message that they bowled 5 overs out of their power play overs of the fifth bowler, which is incredible. I mean, you know, so we have to give them credit for that. They worked that out. And I don't think I would have done that. I think I would have tried Partharana earlier and gone in some different directions. But yeah, maybe with Teekshana. Just because he's so wicket to wicket and the bounce was one of the things that was a problem there, I probably would have gone with him ahead of Hasaranga at that stage. But Hasaranga still got a couple of wickets. Like, I kind of feel at a certain point, like, you could be Kyle Jameson or Chad Soper or you know, Jeremy Snape bowling moonballs on that wicket, and you probably would have looked okay at certain points.
I would have gone with Teekshana over Tushara because I felt like Tushara was sticking with that fuller length delivery. And I don't know how useful that is on this sort of surface, right? And like you said, Teekshana is wicket to wicket. Maybe he could have gotten that new ball to skid. I don't know. These are all, like, you know, things that we can say.
I think Tushara is the one guy I probably would have given him one over. He got a wicket in his first over but went for runs. Am I remembering that right?
Yes, I believe so. If not the first, then definitely the second.
Yeah, and I think maybe that was another reason that they gave him more. He was the one that probably suited that wicket the least, I would have thought. But again, there was no template for this because they don't have slingers in South Africa and you don't know which bowler, and now he's got a wicket. So it's so random, a game like that, and you have to be perfect to bowl a team out for 76. And to be fair to Sri Lanka, I thought they were pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I think the game was quite tight in the end and a few more runs. You never know what would happen. And Varun in the comments has confirmed that 9 overs, in the first 9 overs, we had 6 overs of Matthews and Charnica. So there you have it. Anyway, let's move on. Let's go to the other big game in these last 4 games, which was West Indies versus Papua New Guinea. The West Indies
chased down 137. Did you ever think you'd say that sentence, by the way? The big game, no. West Indies versus Papua New Guinea. It's not natural.
I really enjoyed this game.
Yeah.
Love this game. The West Indies did chase down 137 in 19 overs, but Papua New Guinea made them sweat. It was a spirited performance. We saw a half century by CC Bao in the first innings and then a phenomenal choke via spin with the slow left armer John Carrico. I think he took 1 for 17. And then Asad Bala, the captain, his right arm offies return figures of 2 for 28. Not to forget Ali Nau's first over, right? Struck with his first delivery in the T20 World Cup. Would have also had Nicholas Puran had they reviewed. I mean, there was a world somewhere in the multiverse where Papua New Guinea would have won this game, Jared.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket 8 is your place for cricket intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, they had plenty of chances to win this game, really. I think there was an element of West Indies playing it like it was an associate game. So when Now started bowling well, and then the spinners came on, they were like, okay, we'll give them the next four or five overs and then we'll step it up. But the problem was it just wasn't an easy wicket to ever play a big shot on. Yeah. It wasn't difficult like the New York wicket was, but it just wasn't a wicket that it was, you know, it was easy to get away a big shot from a good ball. And the thing with Papua New Guinea is, you know, having watched them over the last 4 or 5 years, they don't make a lot of mistakes, right? So if there is a tricky wicket, they're just like, great, well, we're going to more or less bowl the ball in the right area and we're going to all field as a unit and we're not going to make any mistakes and you're going to have to whack us away. And what happens to them at the major level is they don't have that sort of Trumpleman or Bilal Khan type player. And so quite often teams don't lose early wickets against them. Then eventually you just start to line them up. And that's kind of what I thought Nicholas Puran and Brandon King were doing. I thought they were going too slow, but also thought, well, they're in now. And there was that one big over when Sesa Bol came on to bowl his off spin and Puran just went after him. And I was like, okay, great. Well, we had our fun and now it's going to go. And it just never happened, right? It just never happened. And they just kept getting themselves under more and more pressure until suddenly they're in a situation where the mass wasn't working for them. Like, forget anything else. Like, you're looking at it going, so I think they need a 50 of 34 or something. And I'm like,
they need 40 odd in the last.
They needed 40 off the last 24. But before that, even when it was about 30, 35.
52 and 6. They needed 52 runs in 6 overs.
Yeah. So I was looking at that and going, well, on this wicket, that's not an equation I want my team to be in. Right. Like that. And it's all that period from when, you know, when Now was bowling through to, I don't know, the ninth over or whenever it was, outside of the Sesi Bal over that did go for 18 in the middle of that, hilariously. But it was all that period. But they just kept building it up. But, and I think you know this, you're probably on the chat. I know certainly some of my other chats got the full brunt of this. The West Indies did not try and bowl Papua New Guinea out. Right. The batters will get a lot of bad credit for what they did, and I think they played a part in it. I do think the wicket was probably worse than we thought. But what the fuck were the West Indian bowlers doing, right? And not just that, what was Robin Powell doing? Why is Roston Chase bowling like the 18th, 17th over, whenever it was? Like, they were not trying to bowl that team out at any stage, right? And that's what...
On that surface, Robin Powell, who was the captain, gave 4 overs to Roston Chase, only 3 to Akil Hussain, who was bowling that seam-up delivery, right? That swings away from the left-hander and swings into the right-hander. Got a wicket off that too. His figures were 1 for 9 in 3 overs. You bowl Akil Hussain out, right? At least Mothi went for a few runs, so I can understand that. But bowling out Chase and not Akil was something that completely went over my head. But, and then also giving too many overs to Romario.
Yeah, exactly. But to go back, you make a good point. Mothi went for runs, so you take him off. Except for the fact that you want him to come back after he's been hit for runs. And also, the left-handers weren't all still there again. Like, the batting order had changed. He was only to do left-handers. Amini and Sesa Bal both played him quite well, I thought, almost from the moment he came on. But Roston Chase also got belted early, right? And they kept giving him the ball. But also, who was the most likely to get wickets in that game? It's probably Alzari Joseph and Andre Russell. He also didn't bowl Andre Russell out. And then Alzari is bowling back of a length cutters into the wicket. And that's fine if you were playing in the IPL and everyone's whacking sixes off you and you're trying to take the pace off it. Why are you doing that to Chad Soper? Right? How are you going to get him out? He couldn't even hit them half the time. I think he just, like, I think he got 9 of 10. I don't know how many of those balls he actually hit. I think everything I saw was an inside edge or hit his thigh pad and they stole a single. It's like, you're bowling to the Papua New Guinea tail. You are a 90 miles an hour bowler. You've just bowled someone. Bowl at the stumps. Bowl at, and Andre Russell sitting there going, am I going to bowl? Like, and it really looked like they were playing it like it was a warm-up game. It's not a warm-up game. I had a friend saying to me, oh, maybe they just want to see, you know, Papua New Guinea to get a few more runs because if they get a few more runs, it's better for their chase. I was like, why would you want to do that in Guyana? It was, I was so angry at the way they bowled. And I think everyone forgot about that because of how they batted.
Yeah. I mean, if you're Zari Joseph, you want to go full and straight and quick, right? I mean, Papua New Guinea will definitely fold. If not clean bowled, they'll be LBW or something.
Well, certainly their tail.
But yeah, I did not understand the captaincy.
Different. If
yeah.
you've got Sesay Bal out there, you do think. Mind you, Sesay Bal was one of the guys who was bowled. So, but, yeah. you know, against Charles Amin is a really good all-rounder, but he probably averages around 20-22 at the lower level of T20 cricket. Great. I want to see what happens when you hit him in the head and you hit him in the toes, right, a couple of times. And then Dariga. I don't think I've ever seen Dariga bat that well before, right?
Yeah.
Certainly not against
He also kept really
level.
Well.
Yeah. So
really kept well.
He's a brilliant keeper. He's a brilliant mover. It was just... So I just thought West Indies got that game wrong in so many different ways. Tactically, bowling lengths, bowling lines, the batting, just over and over again. And they're lucky that Roston Chase played a really good innings at the end to get them over the line.
Yeah, it was that six by Roston Chase. And then when Dre Russ came in, he hit a six or two. And that really changed the complexion of that chase. Otherwise, it had gotten really nervy. But other than that, I just like to give the Papua New Guinea fielders, plus the keeper Dariga, I think he kept really well, a lot of credit. The only guy who wasn't good in the field was Hiri, who gets a pass because that might just be the best name across all 20 teams, right?
I think he was also worse with the bat than he was in the field. So yeah. He didn't have a good game.
But barring him... Yeah, barring him, I think they were on point. And I mean, I love the fact that already, you know, we've got three bangers. Of course, there was today's game at night, the Sri Lanka-South Africa one. But other than that, we've got some great, fantastic encounters already. Coming to Namibia versus Oman. Dramatic super over win by Namibia. But it should never have gone that far. I mean, Oman's Mehran Khan defended 5 runs in the final over against all odds. He took 2 wickets as well. That's a record, by the way. No one has defended that low a total in the final over of T20 World Cup. His overall figures were 3 for 7 in 3 overs. So two questions. Why was he not bowled out? And also, why did he not bowl the super over? Why was it given to Bilal?
Bilal is their best bowler, right? Like I'm kind of with it. I think it was a surface that obviously helped. I don't know, what is he bowl? Slow, medium stuff. You know, so I think from that point of view, it was maybe they were just thinking he got away with it for 3 overs, but realistically, and it's a very different situation when you're chasing 18 and you're chipping that kind of bowler around than when you're just standing there trying to whack them for 6. So let's give them the benefit of the doubt. They went with their best bowler, but yeah, I'm with you. It was a fascinating game. I didn't get up for the whole game. So I kept setting my alarm for different times and getting up to watch what was going on. And, you know, the first time I was like, well, this game's probably over when they made 109. And, you know, and then Namibia started quite, you know, got lost a wicket, but, you know, didn't lose many wickets. And then I think they were about 3 for in the 14th over or something when I got up the last time.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, I'll watch this, but it'll peter out to nothing. And then suddenly you're just like, and like, you know, when you're watching it half asleep and you think to yourself, is this actually happening? Because I felt like, and it's the only time. So I backed Papua New Guinea in their game at quite long odds. I backed USA in their game. And this was the only game where I was just like, this can't, like, I just felt like I'd got lucky too many times before with my betting. Where I was like, I can't believe I'm seeing the same trend. There's no way Oman could do this. But you're watching it going, Namibia are just digging themselves into this hole. And it's, you know, it's so fascinating how different this has been than the IPL that we just covered of just everything else. But all credit to the bowling units of both sides. Obviously, the pitch has helped. But I think it does show you the limitations of the batting on both sides. You know, I've been saying for a couple of years that Namibia is big. Everyone gets very excited about Namibia, especially when Trumpelman suddenly comes in and takes a bunch of wickets. And, you know, we've seen their bowlers do really well before. It's like, yeah, but can they score over 120 against the best teams consistently? And we saw again, even with David Visser out there, that they can really struggle to get those sorts of totals. And when they're at their absolute best, Visser comes in at around the 15th over and just smashes the ball everywhere and makes their total look better. And then a bit like Papua New Guinea, but with better new ball bowling, they put a lot of pressure on you in the field. Oman is a little bit different, obviously. You know, they're probably, again, another bowling side. You know, Bilal Khan has ridiculous numbers. I haven't looked up his power play numbers, but he really is a ridiculous bowler with the new ball. And then you've got, you know, a couple of good spinners that can back that up. And they always have this random right arm seam bowlers that the first time I watch them, I'm like, well, that's a club bowler. Why is he out there? Why is this happening? And genuinely, that's the person who does really well for them. I remember they used to have this guy who used to bowl I can't remember if it was back of the hand balls or knuckle balls, but like at your pace. And I was like, this guy's terrible. Get him off my TV screen. And it was like, but he kept getting everyone out. And it's a bit like this guy yesterday where you're watching him. If you watch the ball come out of his hand and land and blacked it and you put up a trivia question of what happens next, everyone's picking six. No one's picking, what was it, 3 overs, 2 for 7 or whatever he got? 3 for 7,
yeah,
wasn't it?
1 for 7. Three for 7. Yeah. And 2 of those wickets came in the final over. Right?
But no,
before that, what, his figures must have read, 1 for 3 or something like that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I also slept through most of this game, but what I do for these ones is that I leave my TV on so that if I wake up to like drink water or something, I catch a bit of it. And when I woke up to drink water, Namibia were cruising. Freilich was batting really well. And I, in my wildest dreams, could not have imagined that this game would go to a super over, right? Because they really kind of almost bottled this game, right? They could have lost it if the keeper had gotten the batter run out on the final delivery.
Yeah.
Right? They were biased.
Taken the ball.
But they could have lost this. Yeah. So it was quite dramatic. And I mean, you've got to give it to David Wiesa. Always pulls off this all-round masterclass whenever Namibia need him. Took 3 wickets for 28. And then in that super over, pretty much killed the game with both bat and ball. But the guy that I was super impressed with, and I saw him all the way back in 2021 in the T20 World Cup when Namibia also did well. Reuben Trumpelman, he's now 26. He's a left-arm quick. He took 4 for 21. The first 2 deliveries of the game were LBWs, and both were by Reuben Trumpelman. And he's got the pace as well. I feel like he's ready for a franchise contract. That's what I initially thought when I saw him.
So Varun, and I don't know if Varun's numbers were just him in international cricket, but they weren't as important as you would. Sorry, not important. Important's the wrong word. They weren't as influential as you probably would think. Yeah, like they weren't as great. So I wonder what he does domestically. But yeah, we've seen him take a bunch of good wickets early on. What I like about this is he actually took 4 wickets altogether, and they took them all in very, you know, took 2 of them in a traditional way and 2 in a non-traditional way, which I think is really cool. But yeah, having a player like him with the ability to sort of take new ball wickets is really, really important, right? He's the difference between them and Papua New Guinea, because I think they're very similar sides in some ways. The difference with Papua New Guinea is maybe they don't have a visa, which, you know, is true, but they do have Tony Yura, who probably can do some pretty impactful things at the top of the order. But the fact that they have to chip in all the way through Papua New Guinea, whereas Namibia, we've seen them quite a few times before take a bunch of wickets at the top and sometimes a bunch of wickets at the end. You know, they handle that quite well. It's just whether they can make enough runs.
Yeah. And I mean, we've seen them do well in the past. This time they've got a tough group. But, you know, I always enjoy watching Namibia because I believe that they probably are Africa's second best team right now. I would say they're probably better than Zimbabwe. They've made it thus far, right? Zimbabwe didn't. So let's see what else they have in store. Gerhard Erasmus is also an exciting talent, but he was better with the ball than with the bat in this game. But let's see. Let's see how frequently Wiesa can bail them out, I suppose.
Yeah, African team thing's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously there's another African team at this tournament who's probably not quite on that level. I think Zimbabwe should still be better than Namibia, by the way, but it doesn't seem to... Zimbabwe don't seem to agree with me.
Yeah, plus they've fired Dave Houghton now as well. So, I mean, who's to say what the future holds? They've got an aging squad as well. Anyway, let's come to the last game, which was the first game of this T20 World Cup. The longest rivalry in all of cricket, as so many commentators have told us over and over again. Canada versus the USA, and the crowd was good. The atmosphere was great. Canada started brilliantly. Like, they posted 194 thanks to 50s by Navneet Dhaliwal and Nicholas Curtin. But judging by that belter of a surface that we saw in Dallas, that probably wasn't enough runs, was it?
This is brought to you by Cricket 8, the new home of cricket intelligence.
No, I think if you go back, I tweeted that at the time. I felt like it was just such a good batting line, batting surface. And almost every time it looked like they tried to hit a boundary, they hit a boundary. And when you see something like that, you do think to yourself, well, then you should have tried to hit more boundaries. And, you know, also, you know, towards the end and everything else, they didn't really, I think they kicked on, was it last over they got 18? Yeah. But I think there was a period.
Yeah, what was his name? Shreyas Mova, another great name. He was the one who got the runs at the end.
Yeah, who'd really never made many runs before in international cricket. But you looked at the, I think it was the 4 overs before, I think Corey Anderson bowled a good over, Ali Khan bowled one, there might have been, someone else might have bowled a good over as well. So they had a bunch of overs that hadn't gone for many runs. And that's what stopped Canada making 215, 210, you know, even 205. And my thinking was that it wasn't enough runs, and the only thing that would stop the USA would be the pressure of the situation. They'd never chased something of that caliber before. They'd never been in a World Cup opening game before, you know, all that sort of stuff, home crowd and everything. And that's how they started. But the interesting thing about that wicket was it was a great batting wicket all the way through the first innings. USA came out and suddenly it was turmoil. The ball was pinging around everywhere. Like, again, you know, where's Dustin Chanukah when you need him? Like, I don't know how you play someone like him on that wicket. Some of those balls were ridiculous, right? And that was going on for a good few minutes. Sorry, more than a few minutes. Up until the seventh over, that ball was bouncing everywhere.
Yeah.
And then...
it was up until that over by Nikhil Dutta.
Yes.
You know, USA were behind the eight ball throughout. And then he bowls that no ball waist high, right? Or above waist. And that's where it all went downhill for Canada.
Well, so the seventh over, they were really good. And then the eighth over, I'm pretty sure I'm right at saying this. So I think Saad bowled their captain, who's a really good bowler. But I noticed he was drying the ball a lot in that over. And I was thinking to myself... because Natalie Germanos had said that the groundsman didn't think any dew would come in. But if you watched in the sixth over, they fielded a ball out by the boundary and there was a slide. And I was like, you don't slide like that unless the grass is wet. Like, it's impossible to slide that much. We've all played cricket. We all know the difference between a normal slide and a super slide, right? And so you were looking at that and you suddenly think to yourself, oh, I wonder. But then Saad bowled, okay, in that eighth over. And then, as you said, he comes on a Nikhil Dutta. And that was my big thing. So I kept backing the USA all the way through. And the main reason was Canada didn't get enough wickets, right? They had to, I think, on that pitch, it was eventually going to stop swinging and nipping around. And they needed the wickets. If they'd got three wickets, I would have been all in on Canada. But when they didn't get the wickets, I just kept laying money on the USA. I think my highest bet was at 10-1. Someone told me it got to 14-1. I never found that bet. I'm still a little bit annoyed because I would have cashed in even more. But I just kept laying in. And the reason I kept laying in was they weren't taking any wickets. And then when Dutta bowled that ball, how quickly that changed. It felt like every over went for 15 from then on in.
Pretty much. Right?
And then you had was it Jeremy Gordon, the Guyanese bowler, you know, older bowler, clearly knows what he's doing. Looks like he has a good action to me. Got the yips, right? Just completely got the yips, fell apart. But brilliant from Aaron Jones just to put so much pressure back on them. Aaron Jones is one of those guys. There's a little bit of Venky about him, right? You can watch Aaron Jones bat five times in a row and he will look like the worst player in the world. And you'll be like, why is anyone talking this guy up? And then you see and then your friend sees the sixth game and is like, have you heard of this Aaron Jones? He's the best player I've seen. I've seen him play so many times now where it's like, he looks like one of us has gone out on the field or he looks like he should be in the IPL. There's no middle ground for this dude, right? At all. And it was beautiful striking. But yeah, I think once the dew came in and they got on top, you saw a couple of things for Canada. I do think they have good new ball bowling. And Saad is a decent spinner, but they have no fifth bowler at all. And they clearly have no death bowling at all. And that was what I was betting on with the USA. And it came true massively. But what a great opening game, you know, from an entertainment point of view, from a narrative point of view, you know. And you look at the first four games now, and this is a weird way to start a World Cup, right? Like, you know, the two hosts have played, so I'm not too worried about that. But Australia, India, England haven't played. Pakistan haven't played. Like, the big market teams haven't actually had a game yet. And yet all four games have been absolutely captivating. Yep, the last one was a disaster and we'll try and never think of it again. But they've all been captivating in really, really different ways. And, you know, there was that moment even in the Sri Lanka-South Africa game where you're like, oh my God, this could, they could actually win this somehow, Sri Lanka from here. And it's like, the same with the Oman one where like I'm half awake going, am I watching this right? Is this actually happening? And Papua New Guinea, we felt the same way. And the USA one, how quickly that changed, right? That was just, it's one of the most violent changes I've ever seen. You know, and in T20 cricket, they say when the train starts, but it's like usually the train takes a little while just to chug in. You know, you hit a six and a couple of singles in one over, then maybe you get a four and a six. This was just like, we're all in. The train has started and it's going at 100 miles an hour and you better try and hang on.
Yeah, they were all entertaining in their own way. Even this last one, and it's weird how the game that is being criticized the most is the big billing game, right? The other ones were not so much. They were more so played by associate nations, barring the West Indies, of course. And fun fact about Saad bin Zafar, Canada's captain, is that he has the most economical spell in T20Is. He bowled four maidens. So good luck beating that one. You can't get into the negative. But he took a lot of, you know, tap this game. And I think that's another place where Canada kind of lost this one. I agree that death bowling is in shambles and the fifth bowler was all out of all sorts. Lots of credit to both Andreas Hoos, who I think had a very important part to play with his anchoring 65 as well. But Aaron Jones is the story thus far. I feel like across all four games, this is the guy, right? I think someone even dug up one of his old tweets in which he said that my time will come or something along those lines. An unbeaten 94 of 40, man smashed 10 sixes, slog sweeps so big that I think the ball went to Houston or something. I mean, yes, we know that the first international match ever was USA and Canada, but this most recent one was probably the best international match between USA and Canada, right?
Look, it was a brilliant innings, as I said. You have to give him a lot of credit. I think he got the best of the conditions probably to bat in. But having said that, a lot of the Canadians got pretty good conditions and they weren't in anywhere near the level that he was in. Andreas Hoos was struggling all the way through, right? He really, really did struggle with the bat. And he was a brilliant backup. Sometimes when you struggle like that, you either go all in to try and slog and catch up. And he didn't do that. He still waited for the right ball. It was just that he batted for so long when it was struggling. I thought they were brilliant the way they went about it. And also, it's great that, I know Andreas Hoos is a import. But, Aaron Jones is like an American kid with Bayesian relations. Like, he's kind of more of an American player, but it wasn't like Corey Anderson was the guy who came out and won that game for them, right? Do you know what
that
I mean?
Is true.
I think that's a very, very important thing that it was still, someone like that. And, also Stephen Taylor, who obviously failed in that game. There's a few American kids around there as well, even if they have Bayesian backgrounds or Guyanese backgrounds, whether it be America or Canada. There's a few kids with sort of mixed, a bit like someone like Max O'Dowd from the Netherlands, who's, grew up in one cricket culture, but also grew up in an associate country and still made it good, that combination. So I thought that was great as well. And Nicholas Curtin, big story from that, but I thought he batted beautifully for Canada. And I've been waiting for him to bat beautifully for about 6 years.
Yeah, loved his bat swing, especially over extra cover. He hit a few boundaries over there, looked really nice. But yeah, I mean, really, I think that was my favorite game out of the four because I didn't expect it to be that good. And obviously, I'm Canadian as well, so a bit of a heartbreak over there for me because I was really hoping that they'd take that W. But it's okay. I'm happy for the States as well because USA is hosting this tournament. And if cricket is a success in that continent, that would be great for the sport overall. Anyway, that, pretty much finishes our T20 World Cup roundup. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Pakistan versus England. And yeah, stay with us, guys. We'll be back after the short ad. You're watching Overthrows with Behram and Jared.
If you need your pitch change, well, NordVPN can doctor any surface to a new location so that your IP address is set for you to win. Want to watch a game on a free stream in another hemisphere? Give NordVPN the ball. Or if you just want to watch a clip on social media that a cricket board won't allow, promote NordVPN to pinch hit. So if you need a VPN, go Nord. Use nordvpn.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months and gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. Protect your computer like a bowler protects the boundaries in the death overs with nordvpn.com/Kimber today.
Welcome back to Overthrows. You guys are with Jared and Behram, and we're going to talk about Pakistan versus England next. It was a four-match T20I series. The last time we spoke about it, Estelle was here, and one of the games had gotten washed out, and England had won the other. This time, similar story. One of the games got washed out, which means England sealed the series 2-0 because they won the last game at the Oval quite convincingly. Jared, Pakistan finally got to bat first, thanks to Joss Butler, though. And he's the one who put Pakistan into bat. And Babar Azam at the toss, I believe he did say that he would have fielded first. So a minor unplanned victory of sorts.
I wasn't even following this one. I think I was on holiday when it happened and I was already deep in my prep for the World Cup. Is there anything I need to know from this game other than that?
Yeah, Pakistan went back to Babar and Rizwan. They were opening in this game. Sime Ayoub was dropped. And Babar Razan actually did quite well. They got to 59 in the power play. And Usman Khan came in for Sime Ayoub. But they kept him at 3 and Fakhar was still at 4. That's something that I have an issue with, because if you're not playing Sime Ayoub, you might as well give Fakhr Zaman the role of an opener.
Well, when he batted good in this series, he came in really early in the power play, didn't he?
Both times that he's done well recently versus Ireland and England, he's come and batted in the power play. So I don't really understand. Maybe this is like them thinking that, oh, Fakhr at 4 will work, not actually looking at the phases of the game, which I can totally expect from Pakistan.
Or their plan is to lose 2 quick wickets all the time.
Yeah. I mean, even though Babar and Rizwan did uncharacteristically well in the power play, I think they should have taken a punt over here. Biggest positive was probably Usman Khan, who got a quick fire 38. And Haris Rauf is still the Haris Rauf of old. I think that is really important, because after that shoulder dislocation, and given the history of PCB's medical panel, we all thought we might lose him forever. But he was really good in the series. In this last game, he picked up 3 wickets, went for a few runs, but he was the only Pakistani bowler who seemed to trouble England. But yeah, they have more questions than answers going into this T20 World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, I saw one of their games in this series. What are they? Are they about 10-1 or something to win the tournament?
15-1.
15-1.
15-1. I wrote a piece on that. You guys should go check it out somewhere on my timeline.
I think that's about fair, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I think West Indies are probably too short, especially after Papua New Guinea game, but I felt that beforehand. Mm. I think 15-1 is about fair for Pakistan. You know, they're like a slightly better version in some ways of, I was going to say Sri Lanka, but Sri Lanka have a much better bowling lineup. But, you know, Sri Lanka's 80-1, by the way, at the moment. I think you can get.
Oh, that's crazy.
I was always planning on them losing to South Africa, just because I thought the wicket wouldn't suit them, and I always had planned to bet on them the moment they lost that game. So I was a little bit worried they might win. but yeah, I think 15-1 seems about fair for Pakistan and where they are at the moment. I think we'd all be pretty surprised if they won this tournament. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm not saying they can't do it, because Pakistan is Pakistan, and Sarfaraz's team in the Champions Trophy was 14-1, but that also kind of tells you where this team is at. Sarfaraz's team was ranked 8th. No one gave them a shot. This Pakistan team has a lot of players who've done well, and they've played the semi-final and final of the last two tournaments, but I don't see them, like, they've got too many holes. Now, Azam is the main point of contention, right? He's getting butchered in Pakistan right now. I mean, scored a 5-ball duck, dropped 2 catches. Failed to dive on one occasion, which is never a good look when you're Azam Khan. And this wasn't the only bad keeping performance. There have now been 2 bad keeping performances in the last 5 games. And when he makes one mistake, he tends to make more. That's the main concern. But I mean, of course, fans have gone too far. They've started to abuse him and gotten personal. He's deleted all of his Instagram posts, and I do not endorse any of that. But you know, 2 terrible games behind the stumps in 5 outings, that does not bode well for him. And Pakistan are probably thinking of whether or not they want to start with him.
Yeah, these things are always really tricky if you have, as you get into the tournament, someone loses form, because it works negatively twice. The first thing it does is it makes all the conversations around your team negative, right? So instead of being like, oh, Pakistan are turning up and, you know, maybe they've got a... It's like, Pakistan have got a problem. How are they going to deal with Babar Azam? I almost said Babar Azam, but I'm sure he's fine. But how are you going to deal with Azam Khan, right? Like, how are you going to deal with those sorts of things? And realistically, it's like, who is the... I'm trying to think of who is the player. Was it Fakhr Zaman was dropped before the ODI World Cup?
Yes. Yeah, after the first game or... Yeah. After the first game, he played the Netherlands and then he was dropped.
And then what happened later in that tournament? Can you tell me?
He came back and he chased down 400. That's how we'll remember it.
So, the point is that if they had dropped him in the weeks prior to the World Cup or whatever, that's not how form and technique and all these different things happen. You know, confidence and you know, seeing the ball and everything else. So you're always in it. Once you're in a position like this, it just goes nowhere. And look at Australia with Alex Carey. Right. Of just being like, no, we think we'll be fine. We think we'll be fine. And then they dropped him. The person who replaced him didn't do any better. Right. And Alex Carey, if they thought he was the better player beforehand, he probably should have played. Right. And if they didn't believe that he was the right player, then he probably shouldn't have been in the side. And so they have to make a decision now. Right. That we have no idea if it's the right or the wrong decision. Even if he drops a couple of catches, he doesn't make a lot of runs. We don't know that the replacement wouldn't do a similar thing or whatever that may be. Not quite a replacement in this situation, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that when you have someone like Rizwan, who is arguably the best all-format keeper across the globe, maybe in Test cricket, the English guy is better. What's his name? Fokes. Ben Fokes, I feel, might be a better wicketkeeper. And Rishabh Pant is back, so he's there in the equation as well. But it's just that when you know Rizwan can keep, do you want to give away all of those, you know, potential opportunities? That's the problem for Azam. Not so much his batting. I'm still sold on his batting. He's the sort of player who on his day can win you games. But this is a question that they'll have to answer. I don't think it's their biggest concern, though. Pakistan's middle order collapsed versus spin in that final T20 at the Oval. Adil Rashid took 2 for 27 in 4 overs, took 2 catches as well, was the player of the match. And Liam Livingstone bowled a double wicket maiden, ended with 2 for 17 in his 3 overs. Moeen Ali in the previous game did really well, I think 2 for 26. So all of England's spinners turned up. And if Pakistan cannot play spin in England, how the hell are they going to play spin in this World Cup?
Look, the reason I back Sri Lanka is because I just think this looks more and more, especially in the West Indian wickets we've seen so far, is spin is going to play a massive part. If you can't play spin and if you can't bowl spin, how are you going to win this World Cup, right?
Yeah.
And that's when you look at, that's why Pakistan should be 15 to 1 and maybe they should be 21. I've talked myself out of it a little bit. But, you know, that's the situation that we're in at the moment with them as a team. And I don't think you can feel as confident with them as you can with other sides because of that.
Yeah. I mean, you can feel a bit confident after you watch that photo shoot or video with the cowboy
hat. I like
hats.
The cowboy hat.
That's definitely.
One thing I would say in Pakistan's favor is this does look at the moment like another low scoring World Cup. And generally, Pakistan do well in low scoring tournament situations. So there is that. I think that is worth factoring in. You know, all the pitches look very sticky at the moment and very hard to get away. So I think they certainly have a big chance there.
Yeah, I think the New York surface and playing conditions, at least if they play on the same surface as they did today, will be a great leveler. Or if anything, it might put Pakistan in the ascendancy because that'll favor them more than India. Pakistan are known to bat a bit sluggishly, right?
Are they playing anywhere else? Are they playing anyone else at New York?
Don't quite remember, but their game versus the USA is in Dallas.
Because you wouldn't want to play an associate team on that wicket in New York if the same pitch comes up as we saw today. That would be, I mean, some of these associate teams have like 5 dozen Chanakas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was basically Papua New Guinea's entire bowling lineup, right?
Exactly. The Chad Soper, like, that is the Chad Soper wicket today. Good luck playing him there.
Yeah. As for England, I mean, great or massive positive that all of their spinners did well. That was perfect preparation for the T20 World Cup. We do expect tweakers to dominate in this edition. So that's good news for them. But also Salt and Butler, they smashed 78 in the power play and they were at their belligerent best. Joss Butler also was the player of the series. Do you think that opening pair of Head and Butler is perhaps the most explosive pair that we will get to see in this T20 World Cup? Or are you going to give that award to Head and Warner?
You said Head and Butler. Head and Butler would be interesting.
I meant Salt and Butler. Also, Hypocaust has just said that Pakistan are playing Canada in New York. So, yeah, good luck.
Yeah, you'd probably rather play Canada than... although, actually, Canada's bowlers might be quite handy on a wicket like today. Yeah. So those are my two options. There's no one else? We've got Brandon King.
Who, I mean...
And Johnson Charles.
Johnson Charles and Brandon King.
Yeah, so no.
Rohit and Yashasvi.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, probably
South Africa
not.
Have de Kock and Reza.
Yeah, no. New Zealand, no. Yeah, I mean,
no.
Probably, it would probably be Head and Fraser McGurk. I mean, Warner and Butler are not playing the way that they used to play, are they? So, and we don't know, you know, who knows what. I don't actually know how India are going to play based on everything. But yeah, I think Salt and Head are probably the two most explosive batters in this tournament, right? At the top of the order and their ability to go there. But I do think their partners have probably downgraded themselves a little bit. But you make a point, you know, it might be Butler. And certainly the way Butler played the other day, he hasn't always been playing like that, though. I think since he's become an opener, he's actually got a little bit more sensible at times, which really annoys me.
I mean, he does have all of those gears to his batting. And we saw in that Butler versus Narayan game in the IPL where literally all of those gears were, you know, on display. He batted like three different ways in that same innings and ultimately chased that score down. But yeah, when I look at those two guys, plus all of the explosive batters that England have after them, they do seem like pre-tournament favorites to me. And all of them are in form as well now. Let's see. I mean, these surfaces will really tell us whether or not England can cope. But lots of good news for them going into this T20 World Cup. I feel like from a preparation point of view, they're like spot on. Mm. Moving forward to our final segment of overthrows. We had another women's game last week. England's women played Pakistan's women for the final ODI in the three ODI series. England smashed 302 in Chelmsford. Pakistan were bowled out for 124. And England won the series 2-0. As a result of this, Jared, Pakistan can now not directly qualify for the ODI World Cup.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And that is a big miss because they've lost all of these games consecutively to England and the West Indies. And looking back, you'd have to say that maybe one or two ODIs versus the West Indies should have gone in their favor because they were at home.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I actually think they played okay against England. I mean, that game, again, did they not start well in that innings? And then it just completely fell apart in the tail again. You know, if they seem to have like one player who can bat in every game, one and a half players in every game. But yeah, they're a long way off England. No one's expecting them to beat England. But the West Indies ones, they're going to bite, right? Like, and the West Indies is a good side. But as you said, there were some close games there. It was at home. You know, there was a lot of things in their advantage and it didn't go for them. That's probably a fairly accurate, reflection of where they are in women's cricket at the moment, right? And this is the sort of thing that should embarrass male administrators and things should be done and they don't.
Yeah,
and I mean,
there is a university cricket tournament for women currently ongoing in Pakistan. I don't know how seriously they're taking women's cricket, but if you listen to them, apparently they are.
Well, they
but
want
I don't
to,
really
don't
trust
they?
Pakistan's.
Their new thing is that they want to, and we will judge them on their actions. But this, the first thing that you do, what you should do in a situation like this is that if my memory is they changed the coach very close before all this, right? Of recent times. Is that fair? Abdul Razak?
Changed a lot of coaches. No, Abdul Razak is the selector.
Oh, he's a selector. Is he?
The coaches are still the same ones.
Oh, okay. Well,
but
that's
they
fine.
Said that they will bring in a head coach. I don't think they've done that yet. It's always been on the back burner. They're claiming that they're going to give women's cricket like equal importance, as they do to the men's cricketers. But like again, Pakistan administrators, you've got to actually see things. Can't just believe their words. And, you know, you'd be naive to just believe whatever they're saying. Anyway, there was one good performer for Pakistan. Umme Hani, the right-arm off-spinner, took 2 for 47 and 2 for 43 in these games. So that is, you know, a good sign. She's a youngster. Could be the heir to Nida Dar's throne. And Nida was terrible on this tour.
Yeah,
bowling pies after pies.
Batting really low in the order when they needed an experienced player to come in and just not go out. There were some baffling decisions with her entry points into innings. I don't know if she was injured or what the situation was, but I was sitting there going, are you going to come out and bat?
This is brought to you by Cricket Aid. Cricket intelligence for you every day.
Yeah, it was really, really weird. There's a rumor going on that she might lose her captaincy as well. Might not be the best idea before a T20 World Cup, but you never know with Pakistan cricket. It's volatile. Anything can happen at any time. It's a pain in the ass to cover. Let's just put it that way. But anyway, over in England, Sophie Eccleston took 3 for 26 in the first game and 3 for 15 in 4.1 overs in the second. She is now the fastest female bowler to 100 ODI wickets. She's gotten there in just 63 innings, one innings quicker than Australia's Catherine Fitzpatrick. And she's only 25 years of age. Is she the best spinner that England have ever produced, Jared? Certainly the best slow left-armer, right?
Yeah, she's the best spinner in women's cricket I've seen for England. She's close to unplayable, I think, in women's cricket at her absolute best. I don't know how she's a little bit quicker than the others. She spins it a little bit more. She's so accurate. She's very clever. She's just got so many bows. It really did look like, especially when the tail was batting to her. Bored is probably the wrong way of putting it, but it was like, why do I even have to do this? There was one game, might have been that last game that you were talking about before. It was like, I wasn't even sure they were going to bring her on to bowl. Because it was like, it was so beneath her to even come on. No, she's fantastic. And, you know, at this level, I really thought they were going to struggle to hit her at all.
Yeah, I would even go on to say that she might be the best spinner going around these days because she's just been so successful for so long. And plus, she can give it a whack as well at times. She's really the complete cricketer. And I mean, I know 25 years of age is quite old, actually, for a woman, female cricketer. But if she gives England 5 more years, I feel like she could break even more records.
Yeah.
Speaking of breaking records, though, back from injury, Nat Siver-Brunt. She smashed a 124 unbeaten off 117 deliveries. And in the last 9 ODI innings now, she has 4 tons, which is ridiculous. Only Meg Lanning and Susie Bates have more ODI tons than her 9. And she took 2 for 11 in 5 overs with the ball. Her being there, just in that lineup, is a huge boost to England, like in batting, bowling, everywhere.
Yeah, she's a very, very special cricketer. It was funny, she said something, I can't remember if it was the press conference or whether it was on TV, but she said something about how she's still learning. And you see that with all-rounders that quite often, you know, they mature between 27 and 31, 32. And even you see Elise Perry having another evolution later on. Mm. And it's because it's hard to evolve your game when you're working on your batting and your ball when you're young, the way that other players do. If she gets better, what a player she will be, right? Like, she's just a phenomenal talent.
Yeah, she's completed 2 years with Catherine as well. So congratulations on that, Tat. And that wraps up our itinerary for overthrows. But we've got some super chats, Jared. So let's head away to them. Bart 881 with a very generous donation of $5 says, loved Behram's impassioned walk through Pakistan's T20 World Cup history. More power to the entire Good Areas team for all that you do to make cricket more fun. Well, you're welcome. And thank you so much, Bart. Path Right Winger always has a super chat. This time he says that his friend and himself, they bet on Stark's Watson-esque comeback. He says he bet on Aussie blood giving horse-smelling the big race vibes. He said Bharat Aaron is a great bowling coach who is going to get Stark's ... length right as per the bounce in Indian pitches as he did with other KKR bowlers. Who was more right?
Stark had a pretty ordinary year. And then I just think if you looked at those last couple of games, I don't think it was that they fixed his length. I think the ball started swinging. And once the ball starts swinging, Mitchell Stark is a very different bowler. I don't know how much that was technical because he certainly wasn't getting it swing earlier in the year. And the other thing is, if you go back to some of the early stuff I talked about with Stark in the IPL, I said one of his big skills is bowling to guys who bat at 7, 8, and 9. And that is because how do you handle a 6'7" left arm quick bowler when they're bowling, you know, at you at that stage? Whereas if you look at the early games, they weren't taking enough wickets. Whereas the back end of the season, they took so many wickets. He got to cash in a little bit again, bowling to the tail, and they struggled with him. So I think a lot of things came right there. But I don't know. I certainly wouldn't be paying him a massive fee. I wouldn't be retaining him if I was KKR. Ooh. And if he really had a comeback to what Mitchell Stark is, then you would retain him, right? You, or at least right to match. And I don't think I would be doing that with him at all for Kolkata. So from that point of view, Parth, I think your friend's right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he did turn up in the playoff games, much like the ODI World Cup, where he had great knockout games. But then again, what if Kolkata don't get to the playoffs?
Well, and season, he right? played a big part in why they sucked at the start of the season at times. Or that, well, certainly why their bowling sucked at the start of the season, right? Like, both of these things are true.
Also, just before I take the super chat, Hypocost has some really good stats that I'm just going to say out loud for the viewers and listeners. He says that Nat Siver-Brunt has made the most centuries from number 4 or lower by any woman in ODIs. Since her debut, she has scored 9 and everyone else combined has made 15, which is incredible. And Siver-Brunt and Meg Lanning are the only women to combine a 40-plus batting average with a 90-plus strike rate in ODIs. So yeah, that just goes on to show you how great she is. Next super chat, Darth Vader. Okay, now we're getting Star Wars people coming in. He says, after Usman Khan's fiasco, why would any associate team like UAE or Oman have any incentive to invest in these players if they just choose to represent their country of origin once they're successful? I mean, you get a good player, you invest in them.
Yeah, I mean, right? my memory is also that you can play associate cricket and then you can play for your international team the next day. But then it's a 2-year wait to come back. So how long will he play before they might have access to him as a player again? You know, we've even seen someone like, was it Joe Burns said this week he wanted to play for Italy.
Yes.
And I remember that. I could get the Hypercourse might know those regulations, but that's how I remembered them to be, unless they've changed slightly over the last couple of years.
Dirk Nannes was another one who played the 2009 T20 World Cup for the Netherlands, but then in the 2010 T20 World Cup, he was with Australia.
But he couldn't go back to the Netherlands straight after.
Yes.
And that's the rule, true, as far as I'm aware. So they might still have access to that player. Ed Joyce went back to play for Ireland again after he played for England. So he played for England, then he played for Ireland, then he played for England again. Ireland again. I'll get some of that right.
Ireland, England, Ireland.
That's how we did it. So we have seen that before. So think about it from a few different ways, Darth. Having someone like Usman Khan around is huge for UAE cricket. It's not just the runs that he makes on the field. The bowlers have to bowl to him. He obviously has an advanced understanding of cricket compared to a lot of the other players that they have. They have a lot of what I would call very good club players and some very good sort of low-end first-class players. He's clearly a couple of tiers above some of those guys. So you have the knowledge, you have the professionalism, perhaps, of the way he trains. And then you have the access to him in the future. They've now built a relationship with him as well. So, you know, I know a lot of countries, associate countries, will say things like, yeah, that's what we build a relationship with them. And maybe they will go off and play for another country. But they will probably come back and play for us again if they want to in the future. And that's all we can really do. That's what they've done in this situation. I don't think anyone in UAE cricket will think they've done a massive disservice. If he was going to get picked for Pakistan, he was always going to make a lot more money than he ever would from the UAE. No one didn't think that. The only thing they might have thought before is he's not going to get picked for Pakistan, so we can pick him. And, you know, and if you look at Ireland, is a really good example of this. So I just mentioned Ed Joyce. You also had Boyd Rankin, although I know he didn't. No, Boyd Rankin did come back to play for Ireland. So he played for Ireland, then he played for England, then he played for Ireland again. You know, Tom Cooper, if he'd been picked for Australia, would have done a similar thing and gone back to play for the Netherlands eventually. I think that's okay, right? You're still getting that player, but you're getting their institutional knowledge and you're getting everything else about them. It's not an ideal world, but they were kind of renting him anyway, right? So, you know, you get what you can out of a rental and then you hopefully don't scratch it too bad for the real owners.
Yeah, also Hypercost has confirmed in the comments that it's now a four-year wait. Yeah. So that does complicate things a bit, right? I mean, players like Usman Khan, who don't know what the PCB is going to end up doing, might have to think three more times before they make that.
He probably is
going to
make more money off a year and a half of Pakistan cricket than he is off 4 years of UAE cricket anyway, right? And
plus, I'm sure Multan has given him some guarantees that he'll get some good money playing for them, right? Because he's giving up on an ILT 20 and Abu Dhabi T10 contract as well. That's the big one.
Exactly. You know, he would have made the decision that made the most sense for him. And he might be wrong, but he's backed himself and I've got no issue with that.
Yeah. Done with the Super Chats already. Wow. That's crazy. We never have this few. But anyway, that wraps up this episode of Overthrows. Thank you to everyone who came in the comment section, sent us Super Chats and interacted with us. And of course, just to give everyone a quick reminder, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage. That can prove to be your one-stop shop for all of the work that we do as part of this team, whether it be written content, videos, or podcasts. And if you enjoyed this video, give us a like and subscribe to both this channel and Jared's other channel on YouTube. We'll be back next week with another episode of Overthrows. That is all for now. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minvo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips.
Try minvo.pro now.